some of you have been with me as we have been gradually reading through and studying, seeking to learn in the book of Revelation. We're in Revelation 17 this evening. Up to this point, John was being shown the things that the Lord chose to reveal. It's called a prophecy. It is the things that God wishes to make known even to us. And as we come through the book and the prophecy to this point, there's been a progression from through difficulties, through partial punishments, and here we have in mind such things as the seven seals that the Lamb opened and the seven trumpets. These were punishments in part and judgments upon the earth and amongst men. Along with that, there were tribulations for God's people. There was the appearance and the in power of Satan's allies, the beasts, for example, several chapters before this. There was then also the eventual appearance in heaven of the saints. But in the last two chapters, 15 and 16, we have been reading that now God's wrath, God's anger, is complete. It is at its fullest. Those bowls that the seven angels had pouring out, they were filled with the wrath of God. It tells us that the time is ready. The time is complete for God's judgment upon the earth. First, in chapter 15 came the announcements, and then in chapter 16 was the pouring out of the plagues for the administering of God's wrath upon men. But there is still activity there. It is not that they are wiped out. There is still activity. These men, as the plagues were poured out on them, they blasphemed. There was still something in them to respond to that. There is more to come before the picture is altogether complete, even the picture of judgment. And for this, a further scene is to be set. And that scene is that John was led into in chapter 17, led into it by one of those angels that had been charged with pouring out God's wrath upon men. In chapter 17, verse 1, one of those seven angels came and talked with me. And he said, "Come, I will show you." And once again, as John has done in a number of places, here is a summary of what is ahead of us. "I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication." That's what he's about. That's what's going to happen. "And so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness." Coming into the chapter then, let us learn here of the amazing vision that John sees, to learn also the appalling significance of that vision, what it means. And as part of it and following on from it, also the assured disintegration of the powers that John sees. So there's the amazing vision, the appalling significance, and the assured disintegration. As we look at the chapter, I would suggest that we do understand it as firstly a scene setting. It's preparing the scene to give something of an understanding of what is about to happen, that we learn these things, what are the players, as it were, in what is going to happen from chapter 18 onwards for a bit. It's setting the scene for that, and John needs to understand what he sees in front of him. And so we see the amazing vision. And I use the word amazing because the Bible uses it, at least our English uses it. Great amazement John had when he saw these things. It's John's reaction to the things he saw. Now, amazing can mean a few things, I suppose. And in its simplest form, without any weight on one side or the other. It means, really, I suppose, simply that the senses are stunned. The thing that's happening or that is seen is highly unusual. But mostly it has been used by us, in more recent times at least, in a positive sense, with a positive weight, that it's about what is exciting more than terrifying. But it could, in its simplest form, it could be leaning on that side as well. But I say this because I'm trying to understand what John really went through. What was it that was his reaction? What kind of reaction was it? And it does seem, perhaps, that it has something of a sense of almost excitement over what he sees. Perhaps he did not yet know, although it tells us what the things were, perhaps he didn't at that particular point know just the meaning of the objects that he had seen. What he did see was something of great magnificence and something awesome, something quite remarkable. And perhaps there was something of almost appeal about what he saw. There was a woman arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. She had a golden cup in her hand. He saw her riding on a very strange beast, but it was a magnificent sight. It was something awe-inspiring. Perhaps a reminder that, yes, outwardly there can be some beautiful things. There can be a magnificent appearance, whatever it is that's inside or underneath it, which John does discover before long. John saw this woman, very richly dressed. The whole ensemble of the woman and the beast that she was riding on, it was very imposing. John doesn't seem to immediately identify the beast as one of the ones that he saw before. Quite a few points in his description are similar, but there are aspects that are different, such as its color. We're not told earlier with the other beasts that he saw, we're not told that they're scarlet, that fiery red of the dragon, back in chapter 12, verse 3. But there are enough things that are similar that would seem to be an indication that the things that he has seen already, those powers that they symbolize, those creatures, several beasts and the dragon and so on, sometime before this. It does seem to indicate that now they are all bound in together, serving to their own purposes, it seems at least. And here they are brought together in God's opening up of the mysteries of the world. But it's not that John has no clue at all. There is some clue to what it is that he sees. He tells us himself that there on her forehead was given a title. Whatever he might make of the rest of her appearance, there is something that should hold him back from being drawn away by the magnificence of the sight. When he does see this woman, there is nothing hidden by the title that is emblazoned across her forehead. Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Well, as with all these things, a great deal could be said about each part of this. Just very briefly, we deal with it, if we can. And the first term, mystery, just the way it's stated there. Mystery in the Bible, it refers to things that have been hidden, but God is revealing. And for a long time, there has been a mystery about the power and the allure of power amongst men. We read some of these things in the way that the literal Babylon, the way that Jeremiah spoke about the city and the nation, the way that it drew in so many with its magnificence as well. There is a mystery about it. And at times, its evil power that still has a captivation for man. But it is that very constant reality about mystery in the Bible that God is about to reveal. God does reveal, and here he is soon to reveal the truth about this one. There is a mystery about her, perhaps, but it will soon be made known. We read, too, of Babylon the Great, and we'll come to this in a little more is said about this in the rest of the chapter. And then she is described as the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. We've read earlier that the angel says, you'll see the great harlot who sits on many waters. And here was the woman and that John saw. He knows that she is a harlot herself, a prostitute, one who sells herself into what should be an intimate relationship. There's no reality to it. And here she is called the mother of harlots. Mother is the one that gives birth. And that's what she's done. She's given birth to all who have strayed away from God. And that's the fornication. But also defied him with false worship of the abominations of the earth. And these things belong very closely together. Along with that is mention of the golden cup that is full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication in verse 4. Did John know then what it was? Could he see what was in it? Well, the vision is told us after the event. Maybe he only understood it fully later. But he did see in verse 6 that she was drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. He did see that. He knew that. That was part of what was in front of him. And so this scene that John saw, it was altogether something startling. It was stunning. It was terrible. It was something that he marveled at. Perhaps that's the sense of wonder, puzzlement even. But it was in a lifted sense. It was a heightened sense of these things. Amazing, he says. Great amazement. Perhaps it was something even of the fascination with danger type of attraction in this case. It would seem to be something like that, because the next step is that the angel raises a challenge to his marveling. He says, "Why did you marvel?" It may be a very simple question to John, but there is something about it that would almost suggest that John's fascination was not quite what you would hope it was. It was something that almost had a pull about it. It's not that we were being hard on John in this. Who wouldn't be? Every man has been. Every human being has been drawn in a similar way by the attractions of the world. And that's what I think Babylon does represent. In all its magnificence, how attractive it can be. But the angel says to him, "Why did you marvel? Stop and think about what it really is. I will explain to you the mystery of this woman." And so that is the appalling significance. Yes, it was an amazing sight, something that was quite magnificent, something that would make you stop and look and even be fascinated by it, however fearsome it might be if you look more closely. But there is an appalling significance to this amazing sight. And that's to be found in the explanation that the angel does go on to give. The things that John has seen. He is also explaining something of what will soon follow. It's similar to some experiences of some of the prophets where they saw a vision. Daniel is one of the best examples in chapter 7, a very similar vision that he saw in some ways. And an angel explained it to him. Daniel asked and it was explained. And so it needs to be. And the angel is prepared to do this. John has a need for it, as does the church that John has conveyed it to. The reality that's hidden by this glorious array, the the colors of their garments and the adornments, the gold, the precious stones, and so on. What's behind it all? What is it really? The only thing is that the first thing that the angel talks about and tends to concentrate on is the beast, not the woman. I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns, and then he talks about the beast. And this goes on, the heads and the horns, etc. First to the beast then. What does he say about it? He says, it was, it is not, and it will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. If you remember further back in Revelation chapter 13, there was the first beast that appeared at the sea. And one of the remarks that John makes, and he repeats it, that he's especially noticed, is that on one of its heads, it had a mortal wound. Now, mortal means dead. But the beast wasn't dead. It had come again. And it was that very wound on its head, that strange wound that was otherwise mortal, but it had risen up again. That was the fascination. That was the thing that seemed to attract all the attention of multitudes of people. And this seems to be very similar, although in different words. Here was one that that was and is not. It's gone. Into the bottomless pit. But it will ascend out of that bottomless pit again. And it will reappear for a time. It's a hard one to keep down, we might say, in the simplest way. But do you see, too, that as it was then, it was the source of amazement, of fascination, of marveling. Those who dwell on the earth will marvel at this beast. It is not, but it will ascend again. It will come out of the bottomless pit. We'll come to the last bit in just a moment. There's an awful fascination about this powerful beast for so many. So many, the ones we know, it is simply those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. Trying to comment on the way that this is put, but it's not discarded, it's not shortened when it is repeated. The book of life, those written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, it reiterates the strength of this, that these things are in God's eternal purpose. But there are some whose names are not there. And they are the ones who do marvel. You see that word? There's fascination. There's to the extent that they will follow this beast. But there is something else about the beast that we must notice. And there is that calm certainty that I see in this type of expression that reappears from time to time in this chapter. As the angel speaks about these things, it speaks about some things that could be very disturbing. It says this one thing very simply, very plainly. It goes to perdition. Now, that's not a very common word. And the perhaps the simplest alternative version would be destruction. But I think perhaps we can fill it out just a little bit more to understand just what that means. Here is the beast. He does rise up. He would seem to be strong. Is this one that just never can be kept down? Will he keep on rising up? No, he says, this time, when he does ascend up, he will come out of that bottomless pit, but his destination is perdition. And perdition is really something along these lines. It is, well, you can say destruction, just a simple insertion of that word, but it's the setting or the state of destruction. It's that you are in destruction. In that setting, that state, that condition, it's not annihilation. It's not that he's going to be eliminated in that kind of destruction, but it's an eternal judgment. In fact, the Greek word for this is said to, as one put it, to stand in direct antithesis, directly opposite to full and complete blessedness or salvation. Take what you understand by the eternal salvation of God's people and that eternal blessedness and make the complete opposite of that. That's what perdition is about. It is a continuous eternal thing. And so he speaks of the beast. Also, as we read on in this chapter about the beast, you see the repetition of the seven heads and the ten horns, and these are quite significant in the description, the explanation of the angel. We've seen these previously. Here it is again in verse 3 and verse 7 through verses 9 to 12, also in verse 16. The seven heads or the ten horns or both together. And we must, I think, understand it as before as symbols of earthly authority. He speaks of them as kings, heads, horns, power, authority. A fairly frequent biblical symbolism. There are also the mountains that the angel says in verse 9, the seven heads are seven mountains. We might suppose that in the days of John that was a reference to Rome, which had seven hills around it. But we can't be finally certain of matching up any of these symbolic details with historical kingdoms that have passed or that are even expected. It's very difficult and could be quite dangerous if we tried to itemize them in that way. What we do need to do, though, is to rest on the realization that 7 and 10 are common numbers expressing completeness and even concerning these evil powers on earth. It says that they're full. They are powerful. Let me just add that never think of evil as just a force, just something that is abstract. It is in personalities, the principalities and the powers. These are real persons. Spirits, yes. People, yes. And these personalities of evil do have a great power. But notice too what it goes on to say about them. Something it does tell us is that there are seven kings, five have fallen. Even there's some encouragement in our thinking, in our response. Yes, these seven heads of the beast, but five of them are kingdoms that are gone. They're fallen. They haven't survived. And then others will arise. There was the seventh in verse 10. The one is at the moment, it seems, another has not yet come. When he comes, he must continue a short time. Or the ten are the kings. They have received no kingdom as yet. It's all to be given to them. It's not their own power. It's something given to them. And what happens with them? They will receive authority for 1 hour. Now, in the light of all the other time symbols of Revelation, it simply says it's not for very long. It don't last for very long. Just a short time. But then, what it does say is that these kings are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. Earlier, we see Babylon, the woman, and the seven-headed beast, they're together. She is riding the beast. They've joined forces, in a sense. But here you see that the kings of the earth will join forces as well. Do you remember what Psalm 2 says? They're the princes which are combined against the Lord's anointed. They're of one mind. It's quite remarkable, in fact. When you stop and think just how ungodly men crave power to themselves, it is surely of politics, if you like, that they see it. They think it's in their own best interests. But here, they've chosen these kings, given some power, having it for a little time, but they choose, they give it to the beast in verse 13. And then you realize why. It's the only way that they can make war with the Lamb. That's their great objective. That's the power of the evil that has taken them over. They're at war with the Lamb. These kings, the beast, and all that it represents. The explanation concerning the woman as the harlot only comes very briefly towards the end. And it does so within the context of what I'm calling the infighting and the disintegration of the forces of evil. I said a moment ago that the woman was riding the beast. The heads and the horns of the beast represent these kingdoms. And what happens to the kings? The 10 horns that you saw on the beast in verse 16, they will hate the harlot. They will turn against her. There seems to have been some measure of cooperation, but it comes to the point of disintegration. We'll come to deal with that a little further in just a moment. But we do find some clues concerning the woman who is described as Babylon the Great. Just see her for a moment, the significance of this symbol of the woman. Babylon repeatedly epitomizes the spirit of the world. The spirit of the world that has no time for God. Isn't that the sense of what was behind Jeremiah's prophecy, the small part that we read? There was a city, a nation, which was the great example of man's great achievements. Nebuchadnezzar, read about him and his claims for himself, his great achievements, man's pleasures, all the time resisting the claims that God might have on men. And that's the very spirit that multitudes do find so appealing, so attractive, so seductive. I use that because the Bible uses the imagery of the harlot, the one that is calling to men to come to her. But man was made to serve and to enjoy God, to know God with an intimacy that's akin to marriage. To know God. What has man done? He has gone away from God. He has become intimate with the worldly spirit, and that's spiritual adultery or fornication. And it's in this way that the woman, this great city of Babylon, the city that's standing in opposition to the great city that's soon to be revealed as the New Jerusalem, the place where God is pleased to dwell. It's in this way that this great city has ruled over the kings of the earth, as the angel says at the very end in verse 18, you saw that woman, she's the great city that reigns over the kings of the earth. She sits on the waters, that's her foundation, of the peoples, the multitudes, the nations, the tongues. Verse 15. She sits there. They belong to her, as far as she's concerned. But of course, to get there, this Babylon, this great city, is the one that devours the people of God. Psalm 14, Psalm 53, they both say that here is the one, the fool who says there is no God, the fool devours God's people. And here is this Babylon drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, in verse 6. That's the significance behind the symbolism. But for all the power that we see arrayed in front of us and the appalling character of it, let's not fear, because there is the assured disintegration. And I've used the word already, as the powers of evil begin to fight against each other. The angel has given this brief description of the fate or the destiny of this woman, Babylon the Great. The woman looked so amazing, so strong, so magnificent, that things are coming about, that all of that will be gone. The very things that make her look so significant, they will make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. In verse 16. The kings would rise up against the woman. Things would start to fall apart, and this great, seemingly great power that is arrayed against God's people, against the Lamb. That they will hate her. They will split up. They will fight against each other. The kings are representative, are they not, of the very nations that had put themselves under her reign. She sat on them. The heads and the horns, we tend to think, are probably representing governmental powers, the civil authorities, as it's described earlier as well. And perhaps some distinction can be made. Perhaps men have often tended rather to pursue their own pleasures for a time. They find them empty. They'll resort to other ungodly efforts to restore hope, and sometimes it has happened that it has been given over to the authorities to take over, even to the extent of removing pleasure. Perhaps that's something of the significance. It's very hard to tell, and we need to be careful of not dividing these things too far apart. But what is clear, I think, is that here evil powers have been combined together to fight against the Lord's anointed, against the Lamb, but the point is coming when they will bring about their own destruction. And that is exactly what happened in the stories of Israel, where Habakkuk is one of the great examples, where there were men who were evil in Judah, and God raised up Babylon to do his work. Babylon thought they were their own power. And God said, no, that's not going to. You're not going to continue. You have turned against me. Jeremiah touches on that. He raised up another power to take them over. And so it has gone on. They will turn on each other in hatred. It's never love that brings them together. It's only a shared hatred of God and his Lamb. And so the picture becomes one of the woman falling from that strong place. There's more on that in chapter 18. There are these other evil persons who combined against her, aligning themselves with the beast. The beast seems to be growing in power. The kingdom is put into his hands in verse 17. Is this not a frightening thing? If so, remember two things. Remember the things that the angel repeated? He says more than once that the beast's destiny, this beast that seems to be rising up in such great strength, even against Babylon, the beast's destiny is perdition, destruction. Not just once, but twice in verse 8, in verse 11 as well. It's repeated to say, this is what is happening. But also, very plainly, all of this is happening because the Lord himself is at work. As the nations, the kings, are one mind, they give their kingdom to the beast. What's the reason behind it? It's to fulfill God's purpose. He's the one who put it in their heart. And it's only until his words are fulfilled. He's over it all. And as if to top it up, in the middle of all of this, there were the kings that were combined to war against the Lamb. There's no flamboyance to this. There's no exaggeration. There's no amazement even about it, in a sense. All that happens is they will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. Simple statement of fact. Straightforward. Almost bland, if you like. It is so certain. So plain, so straightforward. The Lamb will overcome them. Now, someone might say, well, how can you be so sure? The angel deals with that as well. Read on. And he says, for or because. Why? How do we know he will overcome them? Because he is the Lord of lords and King of kings. It's as simple as that. That's, in a sense, what he's saying. What else do you expect? There are times when we can get very preoccupied with the drama of Revelation and all these immense symbols, and they are symbols of great power, and I'm not trying to underestimate that. don't underestimate it. I warn you not to underestimate it. But at the same time, don't underestimate the Lamb and the King of Kings, the God whose purpose this all fits into. It is all only until His words are fulfilled. Now, I've gone on. I need to close as we are reading on through Revelation. We're coming ever closer to the revealing of how things will be at the very end of this present earth. Men are involved in this. Men who are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And there are aspects of this that have a real capacity to overawe us as we read it, as we think, well, look at the world around us. There are great powers of men, and often turn to evil. There are great attractions amongst men, the pleasures of this world. And they have a tremendous capacity to perhaps even ensnare an apostle of the Lord as he looks upon them. It's done it to so many already. It could do it to us. And so we need to take close heed as to the very real presence of the principalities and powers, to take notice of their overburdening desire. The great direction of their lives is to make war on the Lamb. Along with that, if they make war on the Lamb, remember what it says at the end of that verse. Those who are with Him, not the ones who win, who overcome, but those who are with Him wherever He goes, these are the ones who are called, chosen, and faithful. They'll bring them down as well. They'll bring you down, if that is you. Paul warned about this, didn't he? And he showed the precautions to take. They're in Ephesians 6 and the armor that God gives. These principalities and powers are real and powerful. But for all this, once again, we find here, amidst it all, there are clear, sharp, bright indications, reminders, how important it is that we take equally good heed to the, it seems to me, a calm certainty in heaven about these things, about the final outcome. There is that very clear knowledge amongst the angels, and they convey it to us, the Lord does, through them, that all of this is being done precisely to fulfill God's purpose. It's His time and plan that are being accomplished. And it means that there's no power of man or of evil that will ever have the victory. And that's the way of earth and heaven, of men, before our God. May He bless His word to us then, this evening. Let us pray together.